What's up, everybody? My name is Mike. I'm one of the pastors at Revision, and I'm excited to be here this morning. How about you? I can't actually hear you through the screen, so I'm just going to assume that all of you yelled excitedly from your table, your couch, your bed, your desk, wherever you're tuned in from. So a few days ago, I found myself locked in a debate about whether it's better to run outside or on a treadmill. Now, to be fair, my position is that it's better not to run at all, ever, unless you absolutely have to. But if I absolutely had to, I very much prefer running on a treadmill indoors to running outdoors, no matter how nice the weather might be. And I know I'm in the minority there. My wife loves to run, and she would choose to do it outdoors almost always, unless it's freezing cold or raining or something. And I think most people are on her side. So this week, as I was talking about it, I wondered, why am I such a weirdo? And then it hit me. I know why. The root cause of my preference for running indoors is not undiagnosable at all. It's dogs. I'm not proud to admit this. In fact, it's kind of embarrassing as an adult human, but I have a fear of dogs that lives inside of me. Ever since my friend's Dalmatian took a bite right out of my butt while I was little, I've been scarred. Emotionally and physically, not really. But I do have this idea in the back of my head that all dogs want to bite me. And I've been chased by a couple of them at different points in my life while running outside. And so I'm done with that. Just give me a treadmill indoors where no dogs can chase me any day of the week. And I know that's dumb. It's completely irrational. And according to a lot of people, it causes me to miss out on fresh air and beauty and some great things you can experience by running or walking outside. But even though fresh air and beauty sound amazing, not getting bitten by a dog sounds even better. So my fear kind of holds me back. But that's how fear works for all of us. That's what it does. Whether our fears are silly, like the fear of dogs I've been holding on to since I was a kid, or they're more legitimate and serious than that, they ultimately cause us to shrink our world. Like in order to reduce the anxiety we feel, we respond to it by setting up smaller and smaller boundaries for ourselves. Because the smaller the boundaries, the more control we feel like we have over our environment. Ultimately, when we lean in and listen to what we're afraid of, our fears become our fences. Our fears become fences that cut us off from the lives of meaning and impact we were created for, and they limit our ability to see the light in the middle of the darkness that surrounds us, and also to shine God's light in a way that points the people our lives crash into toward Him. Last week, we kicked off a brand new Christmas series called All is Bright. And this month, we're talking about how, even though as we wade through 2020, things feel incredibly chaotic and dark, everything doesn't have to be calm for all to be bright. All is bright because Jesus stepped into the human story to be with us. And Jesus is the light of the world. And He invites us, you and me, those of us who know Him, to reflect His light in a way that makes a difference. But one of the greatest inhibitors in our lives to living the stories we were meant to live, to stepping into the futures God has for us, is fear. And so this morning, we're going to continue this series by taking a look at what Christmas has to teach us about the lie of fear. And I realize some of you hear that and you're going, wait up, fear is not a lie. Fear is real, man. And maybe you're feeling it right now. Maybe you had a conversation with a doctor that landed heavy because the news was bad. Maybe you're not sure what your job situation is going to look like, or if you're even going to have a job situation at all at the end of all this. Maybe your marriage has been struggling and the weight of everything this year has left it at a point where you feel like it's about to crumble. Maybe a loved one's in the hospital or on the front lines of the pandemic. Maybe you feel like you have no ability to make all of the big decisions that lie ahead. Whatever it is for you, we've all felt fear. And a lot of us are feeling it right now. So it'd be easy to say, Mike, what in the world are you talking about when you say fear is a lie? All that stuff is actual scary stuff. And you're right, it is. I'm not going to tell you that it's not this morning. But when I talk about the lie of fear, what I want all of us to see is that fear lies. Fear is a liar. When fear speaks to us, it rarely ever tells the truth. And its lies are destructive. I appreciate the way the Roman philosopher Seneca explained it. He wrote, "We are often more frightened than hurt. We suffer more from imagination than from reality." I don't know about you guys, but that is my life. I worry so much and so deeply about all the terrible things that might happen, that might go wrong, that I end up suffering things that I never actually suffer. Like when we worry, we allow things that are not reality to powerfully damage our reality. I was talking this week to a friend who's struggling with anxiety. She's feeling crushed by the weight of fear over a whole bunch of different things that might possibly happen in the future. And he said, I just wish I had bigger faith, you know? So I told him, well, you don't have to worry about that. You have huge faith. Faith and fear are not opposites. Fear is actually an act of faith. It's believing firmly that the worst is yet to come. Right now, you have more faith in the fears that lie to you than you do in the friends that love you. Which I think is a little bit like betting on the Washington Generals to beat the Harlem Globetrotters. You might be right every once in a blue moon, but it's mostly a bad bet. So I don't think you need bigger faith. You just need to aim your faith in the right direction. It was real nice to sit back and say that, but so often I do the exact same thing my friend is doing. All of us do. We live in the middle of a culture that's become so adept at leaning into our fears that we've created an endless number of names to describe all the nuances of it. Stress, anxiety, depression, nerves, tension, worry. Like, no matter how it plays out, fear is the source of so much of the disquiet that lives inside of our souls. I've struggled with it all my life, and I can tell you this. As I've fought with fear, I've come to this realization. Fear maximizes pain and minimizes potential. It maximizes our pain and it minimizes our potential as it creates self-made prison walls we choose to live within in order to avoid the possibility of discomfort. And those prisons prevent us both from seeing the brightness that's all around us and from reflecting it to our world. And so what I want to do today is take a look at how fear traps us inside the darkness that scares us, how it cuts us off from the stories full of light God wants to write in our lives. And we're going to do that by taking a look at the Christmas story, or actually the pre-Christmas story, the events that led up to the big event in the book of Luke, chapter 1. So if you have a Bible or a Bible handy, you can open it up to Luke 1. It's sandwiched right between Mark and John. If you don't, no worries. The words are going to be up here on the screen. And if you need a Bible, please let us know on your digital connection card and we will mail you one. So Luke 1, starting in verse 5, says, "In the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was also a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly." Okay, so right off the bat, Luke lets us know Zechariah and Elizabeth are both pastor's kids. Their dads, their grandpas, their great-grandpas, way back. And not only did they come from a long line of religious leaders, but he was a priest and they were chasing God with everything they had. They were living the way God asked them to live. Luke says they observed all the Lord's commands blamelessly. And if you've ever read the Old Testament, you know that's a lot. It's a big list, but this is a couple that's doing it right. They're dedicating their lives to ministry. So how's that working out for them? We'll check out the next verse. Luke says, "But they were childless because Elizabeth was not able to conceive and they were both very old." Now the word fear isn't specifically used by Luke here, but if we understand the full context, it's easy to see how their situation is filled with fear. Because as much as babies matter in our culture, in their culture, and I'm not trying to be offensive here, this is just history, it's the way things were, a woman's worth as a human was tied up in having babies. They had no political standing, they had no money, and they had no property. Making and raising babies was all they were considered good for. And if you didn't do that, if you couldn't have kids, the society just assumed that a barren woman must have done something wrong, that she was being cursed by God and it was her fault. So here are Zechariah and Elizabeth, who we find out later in the story had waited and hoped and prayed and prayed and prayed and got nothing. So they're walking around with this heavy cloud of shame hanging over their heads. They're afraid it's too late now and it's never going to happen. Afraid God hadn't heard their prayers or God would never answer them, never give them this thing that they desperately longed for. And their hope is just about dried up and fear is taking over the space inside of them where it used to reside. Fear that whispers, "I don't think God is listening. I don't think you're good enough. It's your fault. I don't think it'll ever happen." That's where they are. And here's what goes down next. Luke says, "Once when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as a priest before God, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And when the time for the burning of incense came, the assembled worshipers were praying outside." Okay, so Zechariah's in the temple all alone performing this holy function. And this was a big deal. Like you maybe get to do this once in a lifetime type thing for a priest. And then Luke tells us an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And when Zechariah saw him, he was startled and he was gripped with fear. Okay, now the word fear has officially made an appearance in the story. But I feel like we can give old Zechariah a little bit of a pass on this one, because fear is what happens every single time an angel shows up in the Bible. Like terrible, awful fear. And we read that fear grabbed a hold of Zechariah. He was gripped by it. In other words, in this moment, he didn't have fear. Fear had him. The Greek word in Luke's original manuscript literally means like embraced or held tightly. Luke is telling us that fear grasped him and held him tight. I read that and I think, oh, I know that feeling. I know what that is like. I think all of us do. We've been there. And we know that once we're in the grip of fear, once it has us, it shifts our perspective. It changes the lens through which our reality is filtered to the point where even good things can appear threatening, right? Even good things can seem overwhelming and scary, just like they did for Zechariah. I mean, he just hit the priest jackpot. Probably for the first and maybe for the only time in his life, he gets to go offer the incense in the temple. And now he's in there and God sent an angel. If he could just zoom out and get a little bit of perspective, he'd be going, this is so cool. But instead, he's overcome with fear. And I can't help but wonder, in your life and in mine, how many times do we look at good things through a lens of panic? How many opportunities does God like set before us that other people would say, hey, this is a good thing that this is happening, but we're maximizing the pain and minimizing the potential of it because we're going, but what about this and this and this? It could be awful. Fear makes everything look like a threat. That's all Zechariah can see as he looks at that angel. And then the angel begins to speak. And he knows Zechariah is afraid. And so you can almost see him trying to convince Zechariah that what he's saying is a good thing. We read that the angel said to him, do not be afraid, which is what angels always have to start with. He says, Zechariah, your prayer has been heard. Your prayer has been heard. You didn't think you'd get an answer. You didn't think God was listening, but your prayer has been heard. This is a good thing. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. This is a good thing. And you're to call him John. John later got the nickname John the Baptist. He will be a joy and a delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. This is a good thing. He's never to take wine or any other fermented drink, and he'll be filled with the Holy Spirit even before he's born. He'll bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God, and he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Zechariah, this is a good thing. I mean, can you imagine being Zechariah in that moment? All those anxieties that have just been crushing you for years. You're worried that God didn't hear you or God didn't care. It's gone. God's promising you a baby. It'd feel like the weight of the world just got lifted off your shoulders. Or maybe it wouldn't. At least it didn't for Zechariah. No. He looks back at the angel and says, okay, dude. How can I be sure of this? I'm an old man and my wife is old. Wait, is someone going to write this down? I've heard sometimes people write this stuff down. I don't want anyone to read this later and think I'm a bad husband. My wife is not, she got a lot of miles on the odometer. She is well advanced in the years. And I think a lot of us could say that about our wives. But just for context, Elizabeth was about 60. That's old to be having a baby. And Zechariah lets the angel know. And what happens next is awesome. The angel is clearly surprised and annoyed that Zechariah doesn't believe him. So he changes the tone real quick. He says, listen up, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God and I've been sent to speak to you and tell you this good news. And now you will be silent and not able to speak until this happens because you did not believe my words, which will come true at the appointed time. This is one of my favorite Bible moments. Zechariah says, yeah, man, well, we're too old. And Gabriel says, oh, look who knows so much. Are you an angel? I said, what's that? No, that's right. I'm an angel. And you're going to mouth off and call me a liar. You can zip your lips. Matter of fact, you can zip it for a while until what I told you was going to happen happens because it's going to happen. It's just this hilarious interaction. But you guys, I so relate to Zechariah here. He's been waiting for this exact word from God for decades. He's in his 60s. He's been waiting so long, he probably quit praying the prayer that he prayed in his 20s, and he prayed in his 30s, and he prayed in his 40s, and probably just for kicks, he prayed in his 50s, and he's not praying it anymore. And now God says it's going to happen, and he's struggling to really believe it because he's afraid, right? Fear is living in the place where hope used to be. See, fear does this awful thing where it fights against hope for room in our hearts. It wages war to get the upper hand so that we believe more in the worst possible outcome than we do in the promises of God. Zechariah has been waiting so long that the fear is winning. And even though there's a part of him that's going, man, I really hope that's true, the anxiety about it that's become such a part of his identity is going, yeah, but it can't be. It can't be. Hope is losing inside of him in this moment. And we know that. We know that he didn't believe, that it wasn't just Gabriel being a grumpy angel who doesn't like being talked back to and decided to curse him with muteness, because Gabriel is the exact same angel who 16 verses in Luke 1, after he appears to Zechariah, appears to Mary and tells her she's going to have a baby. And she responds. We read she was greatly troubled, and she asked, how can this be since I am a virgin? And Gabriel responds to that question by blessing her. So they both get told a miracle baby's coming. They both get filled up with fear and say, that seems scientifically unlikely. And one of them gets yelled at while the other one gets blessed. The contrast is so unmistakable that we know hope overcame fear in Mary's heart. She said, I believe, but could you explain the science so I know what I need to do? And we know that fear overcame hope in Zechariah's heart. He said, I know the science, I don't believe. And Gabriel says, dude, fear is maximizing your pain and minimizing your potential right now, but God is bigger than your fears, and he's gonna prove that he's worth hoping in. This is gonna happen. Because you mouthed off and didn't believe, you're not talking until it does. And then we read, like, meanwhile, the people were waiting for Zechariah, wondering why he stayed so long in the temple. And when he came out, he could not speak to them. They realized he'd seen a vision in the temple, for he kept making signs to them, but he remained unable to speak. And when his time of service was completed, he returned home. I like to imagine that. Like, just picture it. Zechariah coming home and trying to explain the good news to Elizabeth. He had to play charades because he couldn't talk, and there's almost no chance she could read. He couldn't write it down for her. So he walks in the door, and she's like, hey, honey, you're home. And then he doesn't say anything because he can't, but she didn't know that. So Liz is like, what, you've been gone that long? You don't have any words to say to me? Typical man, you don't even want to tell me how work was. But he wants to tell her so bad. And so he's like, oh, what do I do? He's just trying to play charades. He's like, angel. And she looks at him like, we're playing charades. You can't even talk. You saw a bird? Great. You're hungry? You're hungry for a bird? I'll cook some chicken. I bet they had some good laughs about that moment later. But Luke tells us that after this, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant and for 5 months remained in seclusion. The Lord has done this for me, she said. In these days, he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace among the people. It's such a beautiful, heartwarming story. Almost. Kind of. Everything but that whole, like, Liz got pregnant and spent 5 months in seclusion thing. The word that's used there means she did not go out into public. She didn't leave the house for 5 months. Elizabeth got the greatest news she'd ever gotten, experienced the thing her soul had desperately yearned to experience her entire life, and she told no one, and she showed no one. I've read this passage comfortably over 100 times in my life, and I've never really had that phrase stop me in my tracks until now. But as I was reading through it a couple weeks ago, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Why 5 months in seclusion? Was that a thing? Like a cultural or a religious custom? So I studied and I read and I asked some smart people, some Bible scholars, and you know what the answer is? Nobody knows. It wasn't a custom. It wasn't a practice of people at that time. There isn't anything in any ancient writing to suggest that this was normal. What is normal is a train coming by the revision office right in the middle of our Sunday services. That's normal. What's not normal is Elizabeth getting pregnant and sitting in her house for 5 months. So why did she do it? Why did Luke bother to write this down? I don't know. I don't know anybody who knows, but I have a theory. I believe it's because she was afraid. I remember when Jenny and I were first married, and we had all these friends who were young and married. And when the first couple we knew got pregnant, they told everybody right away. And then we all celebrated together. But then came the first miscarriage in our social circle. And after that, something changed, especially for the couples who had miscarried before. People started holding on to the news until 13 weeks. Or for some couples who'd really struggled, 20 weeks or more, because they were scared. And fear suffocates celebration. It sucks the wind out of the sails. It cuts us off from excitement, and it cuts us off from one another. It isolates us, and it robs us of the joy of celebrating individually and alongside our people what God has done. I think that is what the throwaway little line about Elizabeth in Luke 1:24 means. And it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart for her, but it also breaks my heart because I know she's not alone. I know that for so many of us right now, fear is a monster that is maximizing our pain and minimizing our potential. It's building a fence that shrinks our lives and limits our futures because we're too scared to venture out, too scared to live lives that are bigger than we can control in our neat little boxes, too worried that we might fail, we might get hurt, we might experience pain, to go do anything that really matters, to seize the opportunities, the good things that God has placed right in front of us. When we give counsel to our anxieties, when we let our worries dominate our thoughts, the lies will echo loudly in our souls. The lies of, who are you to do that? God doesn't really care and he won't show up. If you do that, do you know how much it'll cost? Your future is shot. It's hopeless now. You're too far gone. You are not enough. Do you know what they'll think of you? Do you know what they'll say about you? It's not going to go well. You will fail. What do we do with that? Because we have all heard those lies. We've all found ourselves paralyzed by the belief that the worst is yet to come and we are hopeless in the dark. I think the beauty of Zechariah and Elizabeth's story is that it shows us how to deal with our fear. They both felt it. They both let it box them in and steal their hope and their joy and suffocate their celebration, just like so many of us have. But that wasn't the end. See, their fear didn't get to write the final chapter of their story. The story ends with a beautiful baby boy named John, born to a 60-year-old couple who had longed for that moment for decades. See, their story reminds us that fear is real in our world, but fear doesn't get the final word. It's okay to give fear a voice. In fact, it's impossible not to. We're human. It's part of our shattered reality. And sometimes fear is even good. Sometimes it's a gift from God, a warning that keeps us from paths we weren't meant to go down. But the problem is, like every other good thing in our world, it's been twisted by sin and by our enemy into something that no longer does what it's supposed to do. Instead of keeping us out of bad situations, it keeps us out of good ones. And it paralyzes us and keeps us in situations we ought to get out of. Fear is real. I have known it for as long as I can remember, and I do not anticipate ever leaving it behind me. I don't think any of us will. And it's okay to give fear a voice. But it's not okay to give fear the final vote. So the question is, how do we live in such a way that our fear doesn't get the final vote? And the answer is simple: courage. Courage is what lets us give fear a voice, but ensures that it's never the loudest voice. That's what you need, courage. So I just want to encourage you today to go and get some courage. That's what you need. Have a great week. I'm just kidding. It's not that easy, is it? It turns out courage doesn't grow on trees. We can't just walk out and say, I'm going to get some of that. They don't sell it at Walmart. But I think just one of the reasons it feels so hard to come by, courage, is that we misunderstand what it really is. We think that it's the opposite of fear. Like somewhere along the line, we all got told that courage and fear are mutually exclusive, and you can't have one if you have the other. And we know deep down we got fear, and so we just assume we got no courage. But that's not true at all. We actually can't have one without having the other. The truth is they only exist together. The great World War I fighter pilot Eddie Rickenbacker said, courage is doing what you're afraid to do. There can be no courage without fear. And he's right. Without fear, there's no room for courage. You guys, courage is not the opposite of fear, but it is the opponent of fear. It's the tool God placed in our toolbox to beat back fear, to put our fear back into its place, to make sure it's not maximizing our pain or minimizing our potential any longer. And it's not a feeling. We feel fear. We act courageously. Courage is what we do in the face of our feelings, in the face of our fears. It's a scared Zechariah going home and doing, well, what he needed to do in order for God's promise to come true. It's a scared Elizabeth staying inside her house, but still taking care of that life growing inside her womb. It's what we do when we're afraid, but we refuse to let fear write the final chapter of our story. Courage is the opponent of fear, and to fuel your courage, you got to feed your hope. Hope is the opposite of fear. When we feed ourselves hope, when we remember who God is and who God says we are, when we remember what God has done, when we celebrate during this Christmas season the fact that God stepped out of glory in order to insert himself into the human story, that God emptied himself of divinity to take on humanity, that God came to be with us. When we remember that, and when we remember that he gave his life on a cross so we could be forgiven and set free, and then he conquered death from the inside so we could live eternally with him, when we remember that, and when we remember that he promised this is not the end because he's at work even now to set all things right and make all things new, and he's the Prince of Peace, and his rebel kingdom is defined by shalom, nothing missing, nothing broken. When we remember that, our hope grows bigger than our fears. Our courage beats back the voices that whisper lies into our souls, and we're liberated from the fences our fears have built that have shrunk our reality and kept us in the darkness, unable to see that all is bright and unable to reflect God's light to our hurting world. Oh, you guys, I want you to know this morning, God is inviting you, just like he invited Zechariah and Elizabeth, to step into a bigger story. To be part of this beautiful narrative he's weaving together to bring hope to our hopeless planet. He's inviting you to play a role that is so much larger than just you. Let's be real, fear is mostly about you. And if you want to live a life that's no bigger than just you, you can carve out a fairly comfortable existence that never requires you to risk too much or do anything scary because you're insulated and you're safe. But I promise you, the moment you step into God's invitation to shine a light in the darkness, the moment you live for something more than yourself, the moment you live for others, the moment you accept that all is bright and you're meant to reflect that brightness, you'll have to risk big and live bold. And you'll need plenty of courage for the fears that will inevitably spring up and shout lies. But as long as you place your hope in the one worth hoping in, I promise that you will find your courage sufficient to do all that he's called you to do. And I promise your fears will never get the final word, because your God will. Will you guys pray with me? God, thank you for being bigger than our fears. Lord, we know that fear is battling hope inside of us, that our belief in the worst possible future is battling our belief that you are who you say you are and you'll do what you say you'll do. Our belief that the worst is yet to come fights against our belief that the best is yet to come. And I pray, God, today that we would hope big, that we would fuel our hope by remembering this Christmas who you are and all that you did for us, so that we could walk out into a scared world and be a courageous church, so that we could walk out into a dark world and reflect the brightness of your presence and your love and your forgiveness and your grace in a way that rewrites the future and points people toward your love. We thank you for that. We thank you for being a God who's bigger than our fears. In Jesus' name, amen.